Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI appeals for an end to violence in Nigeria. The Archbishop of Jos in Nigeria speaks about the violence in his country, of the social and economic problems that have triggered it, and of the responsibility of the government and of the church in setting the ground for peace. An education survey conducted in schools in central and southern Somalia shines the light on the needs of the children in a country wracked by conflict and poverty. And Father Jim Brand looks ahead to Remembrance Day and reflects on how love doesn't cease with death. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday urgently appealed for an end to violence in Nigeria, where a wave of attacks in the north of the country have left dozens of people dead. Emma McCarthy has this report.
Following the Midday Angelus prayer, in comments in Italian, he said that he was following with concern the tragic incidents that have occurred there in recent days and is praying for the victims.
Seguo con apprensione i tragici episodi che si sono verificati nei giorni scorsi in Nigeria.
The Holy Father also called for an end to all violence, which he said never solves problems but only increases them, sowing hatred and division even among believers. Earlier, before his appeals, Pope Benedict reflected on the Sunday Gospel and Christ's parable of the 10 maidens invited to the wedding feast.
In today's Gospel, Jesus invites us to be prepared, like the wise maidens, for the definitive encounter with him who will come to complete his work of salvation at the end of time.
Pope Benedict said the last judgment will in fact be based on the love we practiced in our earthly life, and that for believers, faith in the death and resurrection of Christ is a crucial divide between those who hope and those who do not hope in eternal life. The Holy Father concluded that if we remove God, if we take away Christ, the world will fall back into a void and darkness. And this, he concluded, is also reflected in the expressions of contemporary nihilism and often subconscious nihilism that unfortunately plagues many young people today.
May the light of faith always guide us, and may the gift of Christian love grow strong in our hearts and in our deeds as we join in the eternal wedding feast. I wish you all a blessed day in Rome and a blessed Sunday.
I'm Emer McCarthy.
Thanks there to Emma McCarthy for that report. Meanwhile, the Catholic Church in Nigeria warmly welcomed Pope Benedict's appeal for an end to violence in its country. Speaking to Emma McCarthy, Archbishop Ignatius Kaigama of Jos, Vice President of the Nigerian Bishops' Conference, said that the young people of his nation are tired of being used. They are tired of this violence. Our young Christians and Muslims, he said, want peace. And the Archbishop also told Ima that this Boko Haram group that has claimed responsibility for the attacks targets people indiscriminately, Christian and Muslim. They are not just anti-Christian, he says. They are anti-civil society, and the government must tackle them. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
The Nigerian Red Cross reports that more than 100 people died in a series of attacks in northeast Nigeria's Yobe and Borno states, launched and claimed by a radical Muslim group known as Boko Haram. The group wants to implement strict Sharia across Nigeria, an oil-rich nation of more than 160 million people, which has a predominantly Christian south and Muslim north. The name of the group means Western education is sacrilege in the local Hausa language. Archbishop Kaigama of Jos is vice president of the Nigerian Bishops' Conference. He says Boko Haram attack both Christians and Muslims indiscriminately. Archbishop Kaigama adds that young people are being used by the elders of their tribes who exploit their desperation at rising poverty and unemployment to foment ethnic discord. But nonetheless, the Archbishop has hopes for the future.
Today is Salah. The Muslims are having the celebration, and generally there has been an appeal by the president and by religious leaders, political leaders, that it should be a very peaceful celebration. And so far, so good. Yes, a few days ago in the Borno axis, that is Borno State and Yobe State, there were attacks allegedly by the Boko Haram. This is not new. It has happened before, and it may happen again until we get to the root of the matter. But generally, in the north, yes, there are political problems, ethnic issues, as well as religious problems. Recently, religious leaders of both the Christian and Islamic faith have been working hand in hand to see how we can stop this. And here in Jos, in Plateau State, we have witnessed the crisis that were very, very violent. And I think at this stage, everybody is reasoning. We are coming back to our senses, because even the young people on their own are coming up to say, enough of this. I am a witness to this. In my office, a group of Muslim and Christian boys came just last week to tell me that they are the instruments of violence in the state, and they want to stop because they are being used by the elders or by politicians or fanatical religious leaders. They want to stop. Yesterday, I was at an interactive session, and there was the Muslim group and the Christian group, as well as the army general who was sent here to keep the peace. And it was a unanimous agreement that we should give peace a chance. And the Muslims and the Christians were all very passionate about getting back our peace. So I want to believe that, yeah, there has been a wave of crisis, violent destruction of lives and properties, but somehow we want to get back and start all over again. And I believe that this effort is genuine. So with the appeal and prayers from the Holy Father and with the work going on here, I think we shall have the peace that is required.
It's very important, is it not, Archbishop Kai Gama, to underline that this group, this Boko Haram group, is an extreme wing and a small group that are creating problems for the majority of people and Muslims who are people who want to live normal life in society.
No doubt. They are a fanatical group, what I call an antisocial group, because even the Muslims themselves agree that this is a group that has criminal tendencies. They may have a genuine reason to ask for this or that from government, but to ask that the constitution of the nation be suspended in favor of Sharia, and to ask that we should take away all government establishments, the security agents should all be disbanded and all that, I think it's just going too far. While the government is willing to listen to their grievances, I think the demands they are making are outrageous. And when they don't seem to get their attention, they attack indiscriminately, killing Muslims and Christians, destroying government establishments and so on. So I think it's something the government would have to tackle decisively, namely see how to root out this fanatical group. I don't think dialogue in the sense of mature dialogue between reasoning parties would apply here, because they attack and kill, and therefore the law has to take its course.
Indeed. Indiscriminately, as you said, both Christians and Muslims, it's not just targeting Christians, is it?
No. Even their leaders, they talk rudely about other Islamic leaders. And when they attack an army barrack or a police station, there is nothing that says that the police are all Muslims or Christians. You know, it's a mixture of Muslims and Christians together. So when they attack a crowded place, they don't care whether Christians are killed or Muslims are killed. That is why I say they are a threat to humanity. It's not just about entrenching the Islamic religion. It's an antisocial movement aimed at disorganizing or destabilizing humanity.
How important are initiatives such as the one that is beginning in Jos to try and dissuade and educate young people away from this form of extremism?
Yes, this is where I said our governments, state governments and local governments must come in decisively. Somehow they have acted the ostrich for so long, burying their heads in the sand, hoping that the problems will go away. For long we have limited the problem to just a fight between Muslims and Christians. I have consistently said that there are some other factors that have never been addressed. Social factors, political, economic, and the problem of youth, all these have to be addressed. Unfortunately, they were always swept under the carpet, and then we only spoke about Christians, Muslims are fighting. Now we must address these issues. The youths are all over the place. They are unemployed. Some are illiterate, and they are ready to cause destruction for pittance. You know, somebody gives them 200 naira, $1, let's say, and they're ready to attack, kill, and destroy people's properties. I think the government must have a rethink and have a very constructive system of getting the youth back to their senses, providing for them and ensuring that they are only positively disposed. We have a lot to do as a church. We must work on the youth. As a government, I think they have a lot to do. They must devote enormous resources to developing the youth and shaping them in a manner that they will be helpful citizens. The youth themselves, yesterday I heard, or even on the radio, the youth, Christians and Muslims, were inviting themselves to a common Salah celebration in Jos, which means that the Christian youth are going to meet the Muslim youth and together they will celebrate the Salah. We hope that that will also happen at Christmas. This is their own initiative. And as I told you, the youth that have come to me in the office told me they are tired of being used. They want peace. They want to live in harmony as it was before. So let's hope that with this inspiration, they are going to stop violence and we shall witness an era of peace and harmony.
That was Archbishop Ignatius Kaigama of Jos, Vice President of the Nigerian Bishops' Conference, speaking there to Emma McCarthy. A new education survey conducted in a number of schools in central and southern Somalia has found that children there lack basic essential services. The assessment conducted by the Somalia Education Cluster, which includes the UN children's charity UNICEF, highlighted in particular that hundreds of thousands of students receive no food assistance in the classroom. The findings also revealed that in the schools surveyed, many lack basic hygiene facilities. Education specialist at UNICEF Somalia, Rachel Beck, says that the absence in many schools of feeding programs is an opportunity lost to reach children through schools, which are one of the only institutions in South and Central Somalia where we can reliably access children. Speaking to Vatican Radio's Lydia O'Kane, Rachel Beck spoke of the many downs and few ups revealed by the survey.
Well, there are a lot of findings, and I'm sorry to say that most of them aren't good. One of the key findings is that only 13% of students in schools have access to school feeding programs. So that's obviously a big concern because it represents an opportunity that's been lost thus far to reach children through schools, which are one of the only institutions in South Central Somalia where we can reliably access children. Now, the survey only covered a little over 600 schools, so we want to be very clear that this is a snapshot of conditions in South Central Somalia. It's not comprehensive. We are planning to do surveys later on. But insofar as it reveals the lack of access to food in schools, that is a real concern. There's also very little access to soap, to hygiene promotion education, to a lot of other sort of support mechanisms to help fight cholera, the spread of disease at a time that's very sensitive. So that's a real worry. On the plus side, education partners, UNICEF among them, but many, many others, are reaching an increasing number of children in South Central Somalia through schools. So that's the good news, but there is a lot of bad news against it.
I wanted to ask you, Rachel, what is the age group we're looking at here? Are we looking at right the way through from primary education to secondary education, or are we looking at just a particular age group of students?
Sure. Well, we are looking at both primary and secondary, and the survey focused more on primary schools just because there's more of them. But we also looked at secondary schools and non-formal education, which is anything outside the formal education system. So anybody under 18 is included in the survey. Now, of course, a lot of children in South Central Somalia are not in the correct grade level for their age. So you'll often find older kids in the early primary years just because they haven't had the educational structures that they should have had. But we did look all the way up through age 17, that's right.
Now, obviously, there's an ongoing humanitarian crisis in parts of Somalia. And just looking back to the survey itself, it says that 93 schools and learning spaces are occupied by internally displaced persons, therefore unavailable for classes. Is that right?
That is right. And that is an estimate from our partners. Because it wasn't a comprehensive survey, we weren't able to go out to every school and say, is this open or is this closed because it's being occupied or another reason. But these are reports that we received from our partners who are active on the ground. And for that reason, we would also stress that it could be more than that. This is just what's been reported to us through this exercise. So that's at least over 90 schools are closed for that reason.
You were talking about, of course, the things that children basically need, food, water, all these things. But what about learning materials, things like textbooks,
yes,
all these kind of things? Also safe buildings that children can stay in.
Absolutely. That's completely correct. Those are all priorities for UNICEF and all of our partners. It was not the focus of this assessment because we are moving a lot of supplies into South Central Somalia. So many supplies are on the way, and the survey did not assess exactly what number of schools currently have access to school supplies. But that's probably the bulk of our expenses, actually, is to make sure that just the very basics are there, slates, pencils, pens, the vitals that students need in order to learn and teachers need in order to teach. We are also focusing on the rehabilitation of school buildings, as you said, and where necessary, the construction of new ones. This is an environment where very little is available. So we're working hard to make sure that those things are in place.
You were talking about, of course, your work there, but are you working with any other collaborators or actors to try and bring about change, positive change?
Oh, absolutely. And this survey was actually conducted by the Education Cluster, which is a collection of both local and international agencies working to improve education conditions in emergency areas of Somalia. So this is 100% about different agencies coming together. We have a lot of different local partners, a lot of international agencies lending support, and it's very much a collaborative effort.
I was just going to ask you, Rachel, just if there were one or two things that you were to say that need to be done first, the things that you feel that really are vital, what would they be?
Sure. There's so many, it's difficult to select. Certainly, we need to look at boosting support to schools to provide some form of food assistance. And that can take a number of different forms. It can be food vouchers. It can be meals in the school if that's appropriate and the facilities are there. It can be dry rations to take home so that families also benefit. That's hugely important. And what we're working to do now is to target schools that are not being reached by other feeding programs, or the communities are not being reached by other feeding programs. So food support is a big priority and a huge issue for us. As you said, school supplies and the reconstruction of learning spaces, very important. And these are all incentives also for families to send their children to school at a time that's extremely challenging, when resources are even less than they were before, in an already very difficult environment. But when schools clearly have something to offer and when they're an entry point for basic services in the midst of a crisis, that helps children go to school, and that helps families prioritize education. So on many different levels, it's important to get kids into school, both because it's their right to have an education, but also because it opens the door to a lot of other opportunities.
You just actually answered practically a question I was going to ask you just regarding the importance of education. It's stressed so many times all over the world that children's right to education, to give them a better future.
Yeah, that's right. And again, we do believe completely in the right of children to have access to an education for its own sake. We believe that education is something that every child should have access to. But we can't lose sight of the practical aspects of that as well. Not only does an education open the door to opportunities later on, higher education, better jobs, and so forth, but in the short term, it provides a protective environment where children are safe, particularly important in an emergency. It's an entry point for services. You can have health interventions, nutrition interventions, safe water and sanitation. All of these are saving lives on a daily basis. Even messages about washing hands, things that we might take for granted, these really do have the power to transform lives in the short term as well as the long term.
That was Rachel Beck, education specialist at UNICEF Somalia, speaking to Lydia O'Kane. And now we look ahead to Remembrance Day, a special day we set aside to remember all those men and women who were killed during the two world wars and other conflicts. The day is the 11th of November, which this year falls this coming Thursday. It was chosen because the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month marks the signing of the armistice on 11th of November 1918 to signal the end of World War I. Father Jim Brand shares some of his own memories of Remembrance Day and reflects on the fact that love doesn't cease with death.
In our parish, north of London, we had two war widows. We made a great fuss of them around November the 11th, Armistice Day, Remembrance Sunday. We'd give them nice special places in church. We'd have a grass carpet in front of the altar, and people would bring up little crosses and red poppies that they could place there as a shrine. And then we'd have our Mass, which finished just before 11 o'clock. And then in the church we'd turn on the radio to join the nation at the cenotaph in Whitehall. So we'd be with the whole nation for 2 minutes silence, and then we'd hear the last post and reveille, and then we'd have a little reception for these two war widows. One father was killed before his daughter was ever born, so his widowed wife had to bring up in a brilliant way this daughter, who became a wonderful, wonderful lady. And the other, when I took her communion in her home, she still had the picture of her husband just before he was killed in the Second World War. That's devotion, where love doesn't cease with death, but continues. I was once giving a series of talks during Lent, and for the last of the talks, we all thought we'd bring some special, precious object that meant a lot to us. Some brought a poem, some brought a marble or something, a rock they'd found on the beach, something that spoke to them. And there was an old lady there, very crippled, whose son is a very fine priest in my diocese. And she was always the life and soul of the group. She brought a photograph of her husband, again, who was in the RAF and who was killed in 1940, before his son was ever born. And she passed around this photograph of her husband in uniform. And she still loved him then, perhaps even more than when he was alive. And I found that the most wonderful example of someone being inspired by somebody who's now dead. Somebody who's still part of her life because she believes her husband is with the Lord. And if the Lord is with her, so is her husband. This devotion to people who've died, this gratitude, I find very moving. I think there are two things that stop us getting to heaven. The first is, if I think heaven is going to be all white or monochrome, if I'm a snob, I'll take one look into heaven and say, oh God, they're all there. Oh, pinks, blues, blacks, yellows. Oh, I'd rather go elsewhere. And all hell is one's wishes come true. Hell is a little room with a table set for one. Infinite loneliness. Infinite isolation. Infinite boredom. Because I don't want to be loved by God or anyone else. So let's hope that in this life we get used to multicultural, multi-ethnic. All the religions are going to be in heaven because God loves all, remember. He doesn't just love Catholics, thank goodness. I'd hate it if there were any Catholics in heaven. Oh, how boring. Some of my best friends aren't Catholics. Really holy people. All the languages, all the liturgies, all the colours. Heaven will be Catholic, which means a universalist, because the Lord died for all. So in this life, let's make sure that we get used to being part of a world that has this wonderful variety. Because if we don't like it here, we won't like heaven, and we'll ask to go elsewhere. My old mother died aged 96. She used to live with me for a while. I looked after her, and then she needed to go to a home because she needed a bit more care than I was able to give. And she used to sit in the window, looking out at the garden in the dining room. And her best friend was 99. They both liked rice pudding, but they didn't really like the rice pudding the home produced. And my mother once said to her friend, Doris, Doris, do you think they'll have rice pudding at your next port of call? Doris said, oh, I hope so. My mother said, well, if it isn't any good, let me know and I'll ask to go somewhere else. Well, I don't know about the rice pudding, but if I don't like different colours, different cultures, different languages, different nations, I'll ask to go somewhere else. So that is the first thing that stops us going to heaven. The second thing is, if I'm too proud to receive a free gift. If somebody says, I've always paid my way, never been beholden to anyone. So I'm going to turn up in heaven with all my prayers, my indulgences, my good works. And I'll say to the Lord, well, if not dress circle, maybe upper circle for me to watch the beatific vision. The Lord will say, you can only come here if you're humble enough to accept a free gift, because we're all unprofitable servants. You can only come in your nothingness. I think those are the two prides that stop us getting to heaven. If I think I'm better than anyone else, and if I think I'm too proud to receive. And if we choose to go somewhere else, of course, if we go somewhere else, you pay through the nose, of course. But if we choose to go somewhere else, the Lord is going to suffer an eternal heartache. There'll be one absolutely unique gift missing from heaven. Because we've been created to be a gift for him. He's looking forward to our being in heaven infinitely more than we could be looking forward to it. Because we've been created to give him joy, for him to enjoy our company. I've gone to prepare you a place, he says, so that where I am, you may be too. So let's learn from the fact that the Lord loves all and invites me to learn to love all. And let's, like him, have the humility to turn up at his Father's throne in his nothingness. Amen.
That's all from the English feature program today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.